This is nice. It's very nice to see all of you. Lots of old friends that I haven't seen in a while. It is a delight to be here to practice with you. And this time in an inspiring hall here. How about that? Honoring workers. Isn't it amazing that throughout all of human history, everything depends on workers, and they always get the raw deal? Isn't it amazing? How could that be? It's a kind of one of the marvels of the world. So thank you all for being here. I really appreciate it. So now, I will take the privilege of being an old person to reminisce a little bit about how long ago, when we were young Zen students, trying our best to get enlightened, and we really tried, and we had no idea really what that meant to get enlightened, but it was compelling, and we were dedicated to it, and we practiced really hard. Probably we were really foolish. Probably that's true, but when I look back at it now, it makes me feel happy. Because we were so young and so courageous. And we really believed in renunciation. We were willing to give up everything in order to practice. And it was a noble undertaking, even though probably in many, many ways it was a failure. But in other ways, it was a big success, because here we are. And the Dharma is flourishing. As you probably know, Suzuki Roshi has a new book. And as an author, I really appreciate this trick of having a new book come out 50 years after you've left this world. Not very many people do that, but Suzuki Roshi managed this trick with a little help from my old teacher, Sojin, who is now also joined Suzuki Roshi in the grand project of death, but also with the help of Jiryu, who is one of our Zen Center's new young abbots, who is very much alive and present. And then probably a lot of you have seen this book, Becoming Yourself. And there's a passage, a short passage in there about renunciation. This is what Suzuki Roshi says about renunciation. Renunciation is that A is just A and is bound to disappear. To practice renunciation is to be beyond form and colors. We have full appreciation of forms and colors, but they are bound to disappear. We should not be caught by them. We do not give them up, but we accept that they go away. And that's renunciation. If A always tries to remain A, that is attachment to something that doesn't exist. It's delusion. It's not renunciation. A should just be A, and A should vanish in the form of A. Though it will appear again in some form, C or D. But then C or D should not try to be something different from C or D. In other words, true renunciation is not a matter of making big sacrifices. Because how can you make a big sacrifice when you realize you don't have anything that you could sacrifice? So renunciation is understanding that you have nothing because everything is always disappearing. Everything, every person, every moment is vanishing. So, what's the use of pretense? You're willing to just be yourself as you really are all the time without expecting anything or being anyone in particular other than who you appear to be right now. And I bring this up because I'm thinking that maybe now, after all these years, maybe this is the enlightenment that we were seeking without knowing it at the time. Such a simple thing, but also more profound than it seems. To simply know who you really are, which means to know and really appreciate that every moment you are vanishing. And that's the way to have true peace and ease in being who you are now. The world is so full of stress and anxiety and fear. Your heart goes out to it. But all of that is really just a mistake. There is nothing to be anxious about. And nothing to fear. Sorrow, maybe, yes, sometimes, but not anxiety. Well, that was a long time ago, maybe 50 years or so, and the world is turned upside down and inside out. We were a merry band of Buddhists. There weren't that many of us. Now, there's Buddhists all over the place. Everywhere you look, you find Buddhists. And if you count mindfulness as Buddhism, there's really a lot of Buddhists. In fact, it's hard to find any non-Buddhists anyway around here. But I have the impression that not that many of them are trying to become enlightened. And not that many of them are renunciants. Probably most of them are practicing Buddhism because they're trying to cope. Maybe us too. They're trying to cope. And they think that maybe practice will help them to cope, which I think is actually true. Because the Buddha was very wise and he had some really good teachings about how to live with more kindness and less trouble. But if you come to the place where you begin to seriously study Buddha Dharma, you will always hear about enlightenment, which is a very, very lofty thing. And even though there are so many definitions and descriptions of it, when you think about it, it's not so clear exactly what it is. But what is clear is that it's really, really important and really, really necessary for practice. That seems clear. Because there are, after all, always three treasures. The pillar of our practice is three treasures. Of the Dharma, which is the teachings and the practice, the Sangha, the community, but also the first mention of the three treasures is always the Buddha, the awakened one. And then in Zen practice, we realize that all beings are Buddha. And so our practice and our problem is how to realize our enlightenment. And how to live it every day. Did you ever think So what are you supposed to do after you're enlightened? Then what do you do? When we were young, you know, Zen students striving for enlightenment, somehow or other, that question never occurred to us. You'd think we would have thought about it, but I never thought, what am I supposed to do after I get enlightened? It never even came into my mind. What do you do after you're enlightened? Open a restaurant? Something like that, a bakery? Anyway, we didn't have a plan. I didn't have a plan. So I looked it up, the question. What are you supposed to do after you're enlightened? I looked it up. I didn't look it up on Google or ChatGPT or Claude or anything like that, though I'm sure they know. I looked it up in the sutra. I figured that would be a better source. What did the Buddha do after he was enlightened? Well, it turns out that the Buddha didn't know what to do after he was enlightened. There wasn't anything to do because he was perfectly peaceful and happy and contented. So, like, why do anything? He didn't need anything. He was all by himself. So he just started like walking up and down by the river. It was pretty nice. The sun was shining. It was a blue sky. And so that's what he did. You know, he didn't have a plan either, I guess. But then the sutra says some gods showed up. And seeing that he was the Buddha, they asked him to teach. And these were gods that apparently had been waiting a long time for him to become enlightened. And now that he was enlightened, they were looking forward to his teaching. Now, the Buddha had no thought at all of teaching, because what is there to teach? There's nothing to teach. He was pretty sure that what he had found out, though it was radically simple, was impossible to explain. However, these gods were very insistent, and they said, no, 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 you have to teach. And in the state he was in, he couldn't do anything but say, okay, of course, I'll try to do what I can. Though it seems impossible, I'll try. But the problem is, who are you going to teach? Now, I'm sure all of you know the story, and Buddha, just before his sitting down under the Bodhi tree, had been practicing with the five ascetics, who were very determined religious hermits, who were interested in intense forms of asceticism, extreme forms of sacrifice and renunciation. They would experiment with how little food could they live on, maybe one rice grain a day. They would be nearly naked in all kinds of weather, cold, heat. They would meditate for weeks, months on end without ever moving or eating. They would even do a practice of going into an ice-cold lake and standing in water up to here and not moving for a long time. Now, you might wonder, why would anyone do stuff like that? But actually, in the religion business, this is a very popular thing to do, to endure all sorts of hardships, because it's a very intense experience that you have when you do this stuff. It's a little bit like people who decide they're going to climb Mount Everest, or somebody who scales the rock face of Half Dome in Yosemite, or the person who goes on a 100-mile run. Dangerous stuff, but the views are fantastic. Anyway, that's what they were devoted to. And the Buddha also was devoted to the same practices, and he had done them. And he almost died in the process. We can imagine the incredible religious experiences that the Buddha must have had during that time. But he realized that that was not what he was really looking for. He was not looking for powerful mystical experiences. He was looking for a more everyday knowledge, an unshakable understanding that would free him from the everyday normal human suffering and allow him to live with ease and with love. And when that became clear to him, he gave up the practice with the five ascetics. He abandoned them, and he ate a little, very delicious rice pudding, my favorite part of the story. I usually tell this story down at Arahatsu Session in Mexico, and I always emphasize the rice pudding part. And then the kitchen often serves rice pudding. And I always tell them that no matter how good it is, it's never as good as my mother's rice pudding. So he ate some rice pudding. And that was bad enough from the point of view of the five ascetics. But even worse than that was the fact that he got this rice pudding from an attractive young maiden. Terrible. Because the ascetics had a very great antipathy toward women, especially young, attractive ones. But when they saw this, they just left the Buddha in utter disgust. Ugh! Giving up. No character whatsoever. And they went away. And then, with that little bit of strength from eating, the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and, as we know, he awakened. And now here he was, trying to respond to the gods and thinking, now who am I going to teach? And so he was walking down the road trying to figure out who he was going to teach, and guess who's coming down the road to meet him, you know, in the opposite direction? The five ascetics, the same ones. Well, he thought, I guess I'll teach them, because if they can get it with their crazy fanaticism, then anybody can get it. So he approached them to try to speak to them. And when they saw who it was, at first they thought, oh man, not him. They tried, they thought they would cross the street, you know, to get away from him. But somehow the Buddha seemed to radiate such serenity. And he was so self-possessed and so where he was, you know, that it somehow, in an uncanny way, drew the ascetics toward him, and they couldn't cross the street and get out of the way. And so they ended up meeting him, and they did stop to listen to him. And fortunately, we know what happened, because it's written down in the Turning the Wheel of the Dharma Sutra, which is supposedly the first sermon, the first Dharma talk that the Buddha ever gave. So now I'm going to quote to you from that sutra. On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying at Varanasi in the game refuge at Isipatana. There he addressed the group of the five ascetics, and this is what he said. There are two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth. And going forth means leaving a life of suffering, going forth into the life of freedom. There are two extremes not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth. Which two? That which is devoted to self-gratification in sensual pleasure. One extreme. The other extreme is that which is devoted to self-denial. Avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way realized by the Tathagata, producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, and to peace. So that's the famous first statement of the Buddhist path as the middle way of moderation between asceticism on the one hand and self-indulgence on the other. But it's really important to remember that the Buddha actually did not have an eternal truth that he was teaching. He had no fixed methodologies, no fixed doctrines. His awakening had given him a spontaneous understanding of how to live. And he was always trying to figure out the best way to guide others to that same understanding. But there, he didn't have rules or doctrines. And he always taught according to the person and the situation. Sometimes he would say, go this way, go this way, go this way. And other times he would say, no, 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 not that way, not this way, that way. So it depended, and people were sometimes confused by the fact that he often said different things. So notice here who he's talking to. He's talking to the five ascetics who had abandoned all forms of self-indulgence but were practicing extreme self-denial. So to them he said, yeah, you're right. Self-indulgence isn't any good. It looks innocent enough, but it's very dangerous. And you know that. Even ordinary pleasures can be seductive. So I grant you that. But self-denial is not the way either. That's why he gave that teaching, because he was talking to the ascetics. And later on, the Buddha explained the middle way in a very, very different way. He said later, the middle way is the path between not self-indulgence and self-denial, but between existence and non-existence. And that's what we were just hearing from Suzuki Roshi. A is vanishing. That's what makes A. In other words, we are alive because we are dying all the time. That's really the truth. We call that time passing. I think of this all the time, you know. Like a little while ago, I think I was over there bowing, right? What happened? Where is that guy bowing? How is it that you can't find that moment anywhere? Look everywhere for it, you won't find it. Because it's gone. That moment of my life is gone. If time didn't pass, I wouldn't be here. Neither would you. Every moment, we are losing ourselves. This is not a philosophical statement. It's the reality of who we are. And that's why there really isn't anything to hold on to. And all our efforts to hold on are always frustrating. All the dharmas, the Heart Sutra says, are empty, including the dharma that I call myself. The Turning the Wheel of the Dharma Sutra then says, and what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata, that producing vision, producing knowledge leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, and to peace? It is precisely the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. That's the middle way realized by the Tathagata, that producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, and to peace. So the Buddha is saying that the middle path, the purpose of it, is for us to really understand our lives as they are, not as we project them to be, as we wish them to be. And he's saying that only then will we be able to find peace. And when we understand and when we are peaceful, we will naturally live very differently. So the knowledge that the Buddha is talking about here is inseparable from the way we live every day and every moment of every day. And notice, it's not just a matter of meditate. Meditation is one of eight ways to practice. And when you think about these eight ways of practice, they more or less involve absolutely everything in our lives. How we speak, how we think, how we act, our ethical conduct, both personally and socially, our understanding, and yes, definitely including our meditation. As we know, the word Zen is the word meditation. So in our practice, we do plenty of Zazen. But our understanding of Zazen is that Zazen is not limited to a practice of folding your legs and sitting on a cushion. Real Zazen includes all of our life, every bit of our life. Then the Buddha taught the following. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of stress. Birth is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are stressful. Getting what you don't want is stressful, and not getting what you want is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the origination of stress, the craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now here and now there, that is, craving for sensual pleasure. Not only that, craving for becoming, wanting to be more, to live more, and craving for non-becoming, wanting to get out of this life. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of stress, the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, the letting go of that very craving. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. Precisely the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So that's the first statement of the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha's first and best attempt to create an understandable framework so that people would be motivated to devote themselves to practice and awakening. It is often pointed out that the form of the Four Noble Truths is like a physician's method of treating a disease. First thing you have to do is make a diagnosis. In this case, the diagnosis is the universality of stress. And that's our translator, Thanissaro Bhikkhu, the great American Theravada monastic. He translates the word dukkha, which is almost always translated as suffering. He translates it as stress. That's the disease. And then you discover what causes this disease. In this case, it's obsession or attachment. Here the word craving is used. And once you know the cause, it's a simple matter of eliminating the cause, which will cure the disease. And then you need to figure out, well, what medicine can be applied to remove the cause, and the medicine is the Eightfold Path, total way of life that eliminates causes of stress. The next thing that happens in the sutra is that the Buddha talks very personally to the five ascetics. Because after all, they were pals, right? They went through a lot together. So now he's talking to them very personally. The text doesn't necessarily sound like it, but when you think about it, he's telling them, guys, let me tell you what happened under that tree. This is amazing. He wants to tell them. So he tells them what happened to him under the Bodhi tree, and this is what he says. Vision arose. Insight arose understanding arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of stress. Vision arose, insight arose, understanding arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. This noble truth of stress is to be comprehended. Vision arose, insight arose, understanding arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. This noble truth of stress has been comprehended. So the Buddha is saying, in effect, that he went through three stages of understanding the noble truth of suffering. And later in the sutra, I won't repeat it, but the sutra goes through the same pattern with the other three noble truths. So the three stages are, first of all, you have a deep insight. This is the truth of suffering. I know it. It changes your life. You have a real vision, real understanding, real illumination of this truth, realizing it is not a trivial thing. But next you realize that this truth is more profound than you know and more important than you know. And you realize, I don't understand this well enough yet, and I really have to understand it more deeply. Because it hasn't yet, I understand it in my mind, but it hasn't yet penetrated my whole body. It hasn't yet penetrated every breath. It hasn't penetrated all my emotions. It hasn't penetrated my perceptions. I don't yet know it deeply enough. And I will continue to practice until I do. And you have that sense. That's the second stage. And the third stage is, now I know it. There's no doubt. The sky is blue. You know, I know it. It's not a matter of, I argue myself into it. I just know it. No doubt. Suffering, origination, stopping path. The Buddha understood these things with full understanding on the moment of his awakening. But then he says, so that's what happened. That's what I discovered. What I came to do, I did. What needed to be done in this human life has been done. And the sutra then says, and this is what the Blessed One said. Gratified, the group of five monks delighted at his words. And while this explanation was being given, there arose in Venerable Kondanya, one of the five, the dustless, stainless Dharma eye. Whatever is subject to origination is all subject to cessation. That is the most important moment in the sutra, I think, and possibly most important moment in the whole history of Buddhism. More important than the birth of the Buddha, the Buddha's home leaving, or even the Buddha's awakening. Because if the Buddha was born and left home and awakened and had a wonderful life and passed away, we would never have heard of the Buddha and we wouldn't be sitting here now. And if the Buddha tried to teach people after his awakening and no one had understood, he would have had a wonderful life and he would have passed away and we wouldn't be sitting here now. But that Kondanya understood that somehow, even though it is impossible to explain, one person understood. That showed that the Dharma could be communicated. It could be passed on. So that now, all these years later, we could be sitting here sharing the Buddha's words. And we can practice the same practice of the Buddha, and that we can realize the same realization of the Buddha. Only is the case because Kondanya in that moment understood. And that's why I think it's the most important moment. The story of the Buddha is not the story of one heroic young man. The story of the Buddha is the story of at least two people, the Buddha and Kondanya. And it's not the story of two people, it's the story of five people, or 10 people, or 1,000 people, or 1,000,000 people, or 1,000,000,000 people. It's our story. The story of the Buddha is the story of your life and my life. In Zen, you know, we make a big, big fuss over this. In Zen practice, we say that the Dharma is not the Dharma out there, a thing, an experience, a teaching. The Dharma is what we live and what we hand down, passing back and forth between one another, face to face, person to person. And if that is not the Dharma, there is no other Dharma. The essence of the Dharma is that it exists between us. It doesn't exist in any of us. It exists in all of us and between us. It exists through our connection. So in our tradition, Dharma friendship, practicing together, Dharma relations, are prized above all. Because it's not just friendship or mutual support that we're talking about. Goes to the essence of what the Dharma is. And that tradition begins right here, with Kondanya understanding. And the Buddha, full of joy, seeing that Kondanya understood. And what did he understand? Well, it just says very clearly what he understood. Whatever is subject to origination is also subject to cessation. What appears, disappears. What is born will die. That's it. That's the Dharma. But who doesn't already know that? Everybody knows that. Ask anybody on the street and they'll tell you that, because everybody knows it. To really and truly know it, body, mind, heart, soul, emotions, visions, perceptions, to know it every waking moment, to know it in your dreams, when you're asleep, to know it throughout your life, to know it when you die, through all the senses and through the whole mind. That's the path of our practice. And here's the conclusion to the turning the wheel of the Law Sutra. And when Kondanya understood, at that moment, the Blessed One had set the wheel of the Dharma in motion for the first time. And the earth gods were so enthusiastic about this that they cried out, "At Varanasi, in the game refuge, at Isipatana, the Blessed One has set in motion the unexcelled wheel of Dharma that now cannot ever be stopped by anyone in the cosmos." And in the gods of the four kings' heaven, they heard the earth gods saying that. And they cried out, "At Varanasi, in the game refuge," and so on and so on. Same thing, they cried out. And then in the next heaven up, the gods of the 33 heard the cry from below, and they shouted out the same thing. And the Yama gods, and the Tushita gods, and the Nimarati gods, and the Parinamita Vasavati gods, all the way up to the heavens. Can you imagine? Layers of heavens with all the gods jumping up and down and shouting this joyous saying. The cry shot right up to the Brahma worlds. And this 10,000-fold cosmos shivered and quivered and quaked while a great measureless radiance appeared throughout the cosmos. Well, this moment encouraged the Buddha to keep going. So he kept practicing for the rest of his life. And as far as I know, he never took a day off for like 40 more years. So finally, I guess that's the answer to the question. What do you do after you're enlightened? This. You keep going. You keep on practicing. Only you don't do it anymore because you have a personal need. You do it out of love for and with others. And I've been doing this practice for a really long time. It's kind of embarrassing. Couldn't I think of something else to do? No, I guess not. I'm not very creative. Can't think of anything else to do. So I've been doing it for a really long time, but the thing is that I've never used it up. I never came to the place of saying, well, okay, I got that. Now let's see what else I can do. No, because I haven't used it up yet. Every morning I still wake up glad to sit and hoping to understand a little bit more today than I understood the day before. Hoping that maybe today, a little bit more, I can have more sincerity in my practice and a little bit less self-centeredness. And now that we come almost to the end of my talk and also the end of my life, it is, I realize, you know, it's not bad. I'm happy that I'm happy that I have been able to do this for so long. And it has been a real joy to share the Dharma with so many people, including so many of you that I've been practicing with for many decades. And what a, who can do this? It's really terrific. It's really wonderful. I try not to tell other people about it because they wouldn't appreciate it. They would never believe it, you know, really. But I am really grateful that I have been able to live this life. And I'm grateful to the Buddha. I'm grateful to all my teachers, everyone that I've practiced with, everyone who has carried forth the Buddha's teaching. So many millions of people on the earth today and in the past, our ancestors from Asia who have been so wise and so generous, so compassionate. And I really am grateful to all of you for this community. And I realize how much it takes to keep this community going. And all of you are helping. And I'm grateful for that. I can come in here. I don't need to do anything. No arrangements, nothing. All I have to do is get on an airplane and it's all done. Somebody else did it. I don't do anything. Thank you for keeping this going. Let's go on a while longer.